Okay, welcome back. We had a nice break. At least I did. Let's see. Having missed two lectures last week has screwed up our schedule a bit. I told you last week that first exam was coming up, and I was expecting to get through inverses of matrices and then begin preparing for the exam last week. But so this week I'm going to start off reviewing a topic that we haven't touched upon since our last meeting, how to solve linear systems. I'll give a quick example of that. The row reduction part of the example is something that we'll use again today, but in a different fashion. We won't use row reduction so much to solve a system of equations directly. Rather, we'll use row reduction to figure out what the inverse of a matrix is. But let me first get to some administrative details. Homework set three, solutions, actually the solutions of problem sets one through five have been posted on Canvas. I did that this morning. That's because I want to help you get through the homework. So I've done sample problems. In fact, what I've done is I've replicated the assignment as best I can. Just remember that WebAssign, it randomizes the numbers in the problem, so I can't do exactly the same problems that WebAssign would give you. But I've done similar problems where the numbers have been changed, and that should help you work through. What I really need you to do is get your hands dirty and do the row reduction when you solve linear systems. That's a key calculation that's not that hard once you've done it a couple times, but the first time you've done it is on the exam. Well, all your reading is not going to help because you're just not going to recognize the situation you're in at a given step. So I'll go through an example of that. I think what will happen this week is I will anyway get through the inverses of matrices, but the homework that I can assign for that is not going to be due until next Monday. And in fact, what I'm assigning today is homework set four, which deals with solving linear systems, and homework set five, which is a bit shorter, but it deals with calculating the inverse of a matrices. Once you finish homework sets four and five, at least from a calculational point of view, you should be prepared for the first exam. But I think the earliest that we could have the first exam might be Friday of next week. So that I'm not sure what the university policy is. I'm supposed to have 6 week grades done by the 6 weeks, but seeing we lost effectively a week last week, I'm not sure if they're going to revise that policy or not. So my apologies if I don't get the grades actually done in time to give you your 6 week grades. But I'll strive to do that. I'm actually not required because this is 3,000 level classes and above are not required to submit 6 week grades. But it is time that people should figure out how well they're doing in the course. So we'll do an exam that will give you some feedback. But that exam is not likely to occur at the earliest, maybe Friday of next week. More likely, I'll give you the weekend to prepare for a Monday exam, so maybe 2 weeks from today. Okay, so any questions? All right, so what I want to do is since it's been, at least in my mind, such a long time since I talked about solving linear systems, I'm going to run through a quick example so you know how that procedure goes, and then we'll take up a new topic, inverses of matrices. All right, so let's see if I can begin this. So here's a system of what looks like three equations, and I count four unknowns. So this is a 3 by 4 linear system, and what I want to do in this example is I want to express the solution of this system as a hyperplane. All right, so let's remember, focus on our goal here. By a hyperplane, what I mean is a set of vectors of the form where you start off at a given point And then you stray from that point along a fixed set of directions. Okay, dk, and then you let these parameters t1 through tk range over the entire real line. And what that construction does is it takes a point and allows you to stray from that point in a bunch of fixed directions or linear combinations of those directions, and you end up filling out what looks to be like a smaller vector space embedded inside the larger space of variables. So where this hyperplane actually sits depends on what kind of vectors P0, V1, and up through VK are. If these are 10-dimensional vectors, this hyperplane is going to sit in a 10-dimensional space, but this number, the dimension of that hyperplane is going to be lower than the 10-dimensional space that it sits in. Its dimension is effectively determined by the number of independent directions from which you can stray from your starting point. Okay, so I introduced this the first week of class, and the goal of our method of solving linear systems is actually to present the solution set as a bunch of vectors living on a hyperplane. Okay, so let's proceed. The first step was to take the coefficients, the 1, 1, and the 2, the 2, 2, 1, and 5, arrange those as in a what would be, I guess, three rows and four columns, so a 3x4 matrix, and then this last bit here, B, it's this column vector on the right-hand side. All right, so here's the augmented matrix that corresponds to the original linear system. And our method is to transform this augmented matrix to the augmented matrix of the solution using row reduction. So, for example, when you do row reduction, the first thing you look at, and in fact, for quite a while right now, we're going to be concentrating on pivots. So that's good. See if I have a working pen. The pivots are the first non-zero entries in a row. So there's a pivot, and there's a pivot, and there's a pivot. To get this, our first goal is to get this matrix in row echelon form. And so what I'll need to do is clear out this pivot that's sitting below the pivot in the upper left-hand corner. So I will subtract 2 times the first row. So this becomes 2, and it could cancel that. So we do the row operation. We get a new matrix. And now we've got it in row echelon form, at least up to the second row. But we have a problem with that pivot lying below a pivot in the row above. So I do another elementary row operation that has the effect of making that row become, in fact, a zero row, because the second and third row are in fact identical. So when I subtract the second row from the third row, I get the zero row. This, by the way, indicates the original system had redundancies. Because what effectively happened is during this process of row reduction that does not change the solution, we found that our three original equations were equivalent to effectively 2 independent equations. This last row, it simply says 0 equals 0 and puts no restrictions on the variables. So in fact, the original linear system is actually equivalent to a system of 2 equations in 4 unknowns. And what the row operations have done is they've removed the redundancy from the system of equations. All right, so here I've gotten to row echelon form, but in fact, we're kind of lucky in this case. As soon as we reach row echelon form, we were also in reduced row echelon form. I have the pivots occurring in the downward staircase. That's row echelon form. The pivots are also equal to 1, and above and below pivots, I have only zeros. So when I have a pivot, it's the only non-zero entry in the column, and its value is 1. So this is, in fact, a reduced row echelon form, and as such, it's going to be the augmented matrix, the solution. So what I do in the next step is having reached the augmented matrix of the solution, Having reached the augmented matrix of the solution, I'll write down the corresponding equations. And now we have to do a little bit of interpretation. This augmented matrix in reducible echelon form not only gives us the equations of the solution, but it gives us a particular interpretation of the variables. Across the columns here, let's attach them to their respective variables. So on the coefficient side, each column is related to a variable. And what we do to make sense of these equations is we take the variables that correspond to columns that have pivots. So that would be x1 and x3. These are going to be fixed. I'll put it in quotes, fixed variables. And the variables that correspond to columns that don't contain pivots, that would be x2 and x4, those are going to be the free variables. That's so that we can take this single equation and thinking of it expressing the free variable, or sorry, the fixed variable in terms of the free variables. And this one, this equation can be used to express the fixed variable x3 in terms of x4. All you have to do to achieve that is move the free variables to the opposite side by subtracting them from both sides. And now we have effectively the equations of the solution, where we can express the free variables in terms of, the fixed variables in terms of the free variables. All right, now I'm looking for a hyperplane solution, so I want more than just the values of two variables in terms of other variables. I want to see this geometrically. So the next step is to take the solutions for the or the equations for the fixed variables that we just uncovered. These two, we were able to express x1 in terms of x2 and x4, and x3 in terms of x4. We set up what's to be a solution vector. First, we give its components. And then wherever we can replace a fixed variable, we'll express it in terms of the free variables. That's coming from these equations, which came from the augmented matrix in reducible echelon form. You follow that derivation there. And then the last step, once you've got your solution vector expressed in terms of the free variables, you expand your solution vector in terms of the free variables. So in one vector, you peel off the constants, one in the first component, no constant in the second component, two in the third, nothing in the fourth. And then you have terms in various components that are proportional to x2. I pull out x2 as a common factor, and then I grab the minus one up here. x2 appears by itself, so it's simply x2 times one, and then in the third and fourth component, there's no x2, so I have zeros there. And then I have terms that are proportional to x4, and I grab those and as a separate term in this expansion. And now what I've got is an expression for any solution vector. I've expressed it as a point on a hyperplane. This is your starting point, p0. x2 is a free parameter, so it could be anything. Let's just relabel it, call it t1. That parameter t1 is multiplying a particular vector, v. And then I'll call x4 the second free parameter, and it's multiplying a second vector, v2. And so now, with this interpretation of the right-hand side, I've displayed a solution vector as living on a particular hyperplane, and we're done. Okay, so that's the basic calculation. And homework assignment 4, you'll do a number of those, but they shouldn't be too hard. And if you run into any problems on the homework, just raise them in class, and we can do some examples. What I want to do, well, first let me pause. Are there any questions? Yeah.
Can you go over basically the right side of the equation? It was making sense last lecture, but I don't know, this one just didn't click.
On the right side of the equation?
Yeah, where all the numbers.
All right, so here I'm just writing a generic solution vector, but you know, I haven't imposed any conditions on my variables. What I've learned from the last slide is from that augmented matrix of the solution that the fixed variable x1 had to be related to the free variables x2 and x4, and x3 is related to x4. Let's go back a stage because this is really important. The equations you write down directly from the augmented matrix in reducer echelon form, they don't tell you directly which are free variables and which are fixed variables. The rule by which you make that determination is the fixed variables. The ones you can solve for are going to correspond to columns with pivots. So x1 and x3 are going to be the variables I can solve for. The other variables corresponding to the second and fourth column, they're going to be moved to the opposite side. And now I can replace two variables with their expressions in terms of the free variables. All right, so that's where these two equations come from. And then what I do is I start by writing down a generic vector. In the next step, I impose that if this vector is going to be a solution of my linear system, then x1 has to be related to x2 and x4 exactly by this equation. So I substitute in for fixed variables where I can, x1 and x3. All right, now I've got a vector that as I vary the free parameters, x2 and x4, is going to vary over the entire solution space. All you want to do next is express that vector as a point on a hyperplane. So I need a starting point. I need some parameters that I can vary times various fixed vectors. And so that's what this expression represents. I grab the constant vectors. That's going to be your starting point. And then you have some parameter, a free parameter in the solution, multiplying a particular vector. So this would be, say, v1. And this would be v2. And then scanning across this equation, I see I've got an arbitrary solution vector expressed as a point on a two-dimensional hyperplane. Right? I have two directions from which I can stray this starting point. Okay?
Yeah, I was looking at
that. All right. So, yeah, that's a basic calculation. And but in the end, we get the geometric object that we sought, a hyperplane expression for the entire solution set. Okay, so what I want to do next then is introduce the last topic that's going to be covered on the first exam, and that's the notion of inverses of matrices. And we should be able to get through most of this in a single lecture today. Here's the idea, which is really simple. Suppose I have an n by n linear system. So I have the same number of equations as I have variables, and I write it in matrix notation. So this would be an n by n matrix times a n by one column vector is equal to an n by one column vector of numbers. And the idea here is that if we had a matrix, I'll call it C, such that C multiplying this coefficient matrix produces the n by n identity matrix, I have another way of solving this linear system without using any row reduction. All I have to do is take this given matrix C and multiply both sides of this equation by C. One caveat though, when you have a matrix equation and you multiply both sides by a matrix, you have to make sure that you multiply from the same side, because A times B is not equal to B times A. So if you multiply on one side of the equation, you use C as a left side factor. And on the other side of the equation, you use it as a right side factor. That's not allowed because you're doing a different operation to the different sides of the equation. You have to do exactly the same thing to both sides of the equations if you're going to maintain the equality. So what I do, if I multiply both sides of this equation from the left by this matrix C. So I don't put the C, it's easy to write it here and write it here, but that would be incorrect. You have to write it on one side and then use the same side on the opposite side of the equation. All right, so we write that. And then this multiplication, this associative, so I can group this a little bit differently. Instead of multiplying A times X and then multiplying by C, I can multiply the matrices together first. Well, because I'm assuming that C times A is equal to 1, this product becomes the identity matrix, and the identity matrix times any matrix or vector just reproduces the matrix or vector you started off with. And lo and behold, we have found the solution to the original linear system simply by doing a matrix multiplication by a particular matrix. This, of course, is completely analogous to what you do in high school algebra. If I wanted to solve 2x is equal to 6, what I would do is I would multiply both sides of the equation, maybe by 1/2, and then I'd get an equation that says that x is equal to 3, right? That's your usual way of solving a single equation in a single unknown. And so what this is telling us is that, in fact, we can solve linear systems, at least the matrix version of those linear systems, we can solve those effectively the same way that you're accustomed to solving linear equations with only a single variable. You just got to figure out what the inverse of A is, analogous to 1/2 being the inverse of 2. You got to figure out what that is, but once you've figured out what that is, then you can quickly get to the solution simply by identifying the inverse of A and then multiplying both sides of the equation by that inverse. Okay, so that's the scheme we're going to pursue now. And the principal problem we're going to face is, well, here I pulled this matrix out of a hat. I just said I had a matrix C with this property. Our goal for today is to figure out how to find such a matrix, okay? All right, so let's start with a definition. Let A be any square matrix with the same number of rows as we have columns. Then anytime we have a matrix C, such that when we multiply A from the left by C, we get the identity matrix. And when we multiply A from the right by this matrix C, we get the identity matrix. We're going to call this matrix C a matrix inverse the matrix A. All right, so we, in this definition, A is regarded as fixed, and C is going to be a matrix defined by these two properties. All right, so let me show you an example. Here's some 2x2 matrices, and if I multiply A and multiply it by C from the right, multiply A by C from the right, I get this product of matrices. Remember, the way you compute matrix products is you take dot products of rows of the first factor with columns of the second factors. That computation produces the 2x2 identity matrix. And similarly, if I multiply the given matrix A from the left by this matrix C, you do the calculation, you also get the identity matrix. But notice here, unlike what happened here in this usual college algebra type calculation, is that to get rid of that too, I had to introduce fractions. Notice the inverse of this matrix A doesn't involve any fractions. Now that's not always the case, but it does show you that fractions are not required to do matrix division. Yeah. Well, that's hard to prove. I don't prove it in this course. In an advanced linear algebra course, I would prove that, in fact, this equation implies this equation and vice versa. So, in fact, these two are, you can prove that, in fact, these two are not separate conditions. They're a single condition, but it's hard to see at this stage of the game why this equation implies this equation. But it is true. And it's just that it's not, the proof is not that hard, but you basically have to understand how to find the inverse of the matrix, and then proving that this implies that or this implies that. That's easily done. You basically show you have a unique solution, and so it will work out. But don't worry about so much that. It will turn out that, in fact, as long as you can satisfy one of these conditions, then you'll have the inverse. And in fact, we're going to use that. But let me show you some quick properties, easy properties of matrix inverses, and then I'll show you explicitly how we actually calculate these inverses. All right, so the first thing is the way I in the definition on the preceding slide, I defined an inverse rather than the inverse of the matrix. But what I'm showing you, telling you now, is in fact there's only one inverse to a matrix, if there is any at all. So what I want to show you is that if you have two matrices, C and D, that have that same property, whether I multiply from the right or the left, multiplying A by C always produces the identity matrix, and similar for this matrix D. What I'm going to show you, that in fact, if these two equations are true, then it has to be that the matrix C is exactly equal to the matrix D. All right, so here's how you do it. We've got three matrices, A, C, and D. So let's look at the product of all three, D times A times C. Now, we have a couple of different ways we can compute that. First of all, we can multiply A times C first, and then follow that with a multiplication by D. What will happen then is that we'll effectively have D times the identity matrix, because A times C is equal to the identity, and the identity matrix times anything just produces what you started off with. So DAC back can be reduced to the matrix D. But we could have choose the initial grouping differently. To compute this product, I could also compute this product first and then multiply by C. When I multiply D times A, I get the identity matrix. The identity matrix times C is equal to C. And so now if you just sort of extend the equal signs, DAC is of course equal to DAC, and you chase this around, C is equal to DAC, and DAC is equal to D. In other words, D is equal to C. So we have, if we have an inverse to a matrix, in fact, we only have one choice. There's only one matrix that will satisfy, one unique matrix that will satisfy both these properties. Okay, so that's going to be helpful. So that means that if we find any matrix, such that when we multiply a given matrix A by it and we get the identity matrix, we know we have the inverse. All we need to do is just verify that the product of A and its inverse equals the identity matrix. All right, and then here's another simple property that actually we can prove. If you have two matrices that have inverses and you multiply them together, you get a new matrix. What is its inverse? Well, this theorem, or the statement here, tells you that the inverse of a product of two invertible matrices is the product of their inverses, but notice that the order of the product is different. Instead of having A times B, where A is the left-hand factor, A the minus first on the right-hand side is the right-hand factor. So what you have to do, if you're going to compute the inverse of a product of matrices, you have to take the inverses of the individual factors and then write that product in the reverse order. Let me show you why this works. All right, so I claim that this matrix is going to be the inverse of AB. So let's calculate what happens when I multiply AB times this particular matrix. Well, you always have the freedom to carry out the multiplications in any particular order you want. So what I'll do is, instead of calculating AB first and then calculating this matrix, I'll just group the product differently. Now B times B the minus first is the identity matrix. Then this identity matrix could be absorbed in either of these factors. and you're left with A times A to the minus first was the identity matrix. What I've shown you is that the matrix that when you multiply the product matrix AB by this particular matrix, you always get the identity matrix because identity matrices are unique. That's how we conclude that this guy is actually the inverse of this product. This proves it because A times this produces the identity matrix. Okay, so frequently, that's how we'll verify that we've got the identity matrix. We just have to make sure that the product, the appropriate product rule, a matrix times its inverse is equal to the identity matrix. Once you confirm that that's true, then you've got the inverse. Okay, and then stressing, there's only one inverse to a matrix. And so B the minus first, A the minus first is the unique inverse of the matrix AB. But we could also say, all right, pin here. I could also say that the inverse of BA is equal to A the minus first, B the minus first, right? You take the inverse of each factor, but you also reverse the order. Okay. All right, so that's enough of an introduction to what inverses of matrices are, and part of what they'll do for us, they'll help us solve linear systems without doing row reduction. Now I want to show you how that you actually calculate them. So, sorry, screen is split. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how you can calculate the inverse of a matrix by sort of an indirect argument. I'm going to have to make a digression into some objects that we call elementary matrices. So let me define those guys, and then I'll show you their utility. If you start with an identity matrix with n rows and n columns, and let the script R be any elementary row operation. Our elementary row operations are things like switching two rows. So that may be the first one. Second one, thing we could do is we could send a row to a multiple of itself. Or the third thing, kind of thing we could do is we could take a row and then we could replace it by its sum with a multiple of another row. All right, so these are the three elementary row operations that we use to row reduce matrices. That's what I'm talking about here. This script R can be any one of these three kinds of operations. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to do that row operation to the identity matrix to create a new matrix. I'm going to call this matrix boldface E subscript R as the elementary matrix corresponding to the given row operation. All right, let's do some quick examples. Here's a 2x2 identity matrix. Here's a row operation where I switched row 1 and row 2. If I do that to the identity matrix, I get a new matrix that's not the identity matrix any longer. It's called the identity the elementary matrix corresponding to this row operation on 2x2 matrices. If I rescale a row, I can do that operation to the identity matrix. I get a new matrix. It's the elementary matrix corresponding to this row operation. And similarly, for the third type of elementary row operation, where we replace a row by its sum with a multiple of another row, you can also do that to the identity matrix, get a new matrix. The new matrix is called the elementary matrix corresponding to that row operation. All right, so I have a way of making a bunch of new matrices from the identity matrix. Here's the point of that. If you have an elementary matrix corresponding to a row operation, then you actually have two different ways of implementing that row operation on a given matrix A. You can either operate directly on it, or you can do matrix multiplication by the corresponding elementary matrix. So on the right-hand side, if I'm saying applying this third operation, what I would do is I would take a row of A and I would add, replace it by a sum of a multiple of another row. Or on this side, what I can do is I can do that same operation to the identity matrix, get a new matrix, but instead of operating directly on A, I'm simply going to multiply it by this elementary matrix. The claim of the theorem is no matter how you carry out that, these operations are different on either side of the equation, but they have the same result. So the upshot of this is an elementary row operation can either be you can either implement it directly on a matrix or by doing that row operation to the identity matrix and then doing a matrix multiplication. Let me show you explicitly with some examples how that works out. All right, so here's a given 2x2 matrix. For reference, the 2x2 identity matrix is this guy. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do this row operation first to A directly. So there it is. But a second thing I can do is I can do this row operation where I switch the two rows. I can do that directly to the identity matrix. So when I switch the first and second rows of the identity matrix, I get this guy. All right, now let's, having computed this guy, let's see what happens when I multiply A from the left by this elementary matrix corresponding to the original elementary row operation. Well, you compute and notice that the 2x2 matrix that's kicked out by this matrix multiplication coincides with the matrix I got from A by doing that row operation directly. So I've at least verified for one particular case, I guess these row interchanges, that in fact, I have two different ways of implementing a row interchange, either directly on a matrix or by multiplying the matrix by the corresponding elementary matrix. All right, let's do a couple more examples. If I do a row rescaling, this is what it would do to that matrix A, B, C, D. If I rescale the second row by 3, if I rescale the second row with the identity matrix by 3, I get this matrix. And then if I take this matrix and I multiply the original matrix by it, lo and behold, I get the same result as before. AB, 3C, 3D, AB, 3C, 3D. So indeed, operating directly on the matrix A, has that calculation yields the same result as if I operated this row operation on the identity matrix and then multiplied A from the left by that elementary matrix. And there's one more example I can do. This is what, if I replace the second row with its sum with a multiple of the first row, this is what happens. If I do that, do the same operation to the identity matrix, I get this guy. And then if you then multiply A by this elementary matrix, you get it back exactly the same matrix as if you had applied that elementary row operation directly to A. All right, so what I'm doing here is I'm not making, with the introduction of elementary matrices, I'm not making the calculation faster. I'm slowing it down, right? This is the easiest thing to do. Just operate directly on the matrix to find out what happens when you do this elementary row operation. The slower way to do it would be to do this row operation on the identity matrix and then do a matrix multiplication to see what happens to A. But speed is not my point here. My point here is to replace this algorithm that sort of hides what's going on and replace it with something that looks a little bit more explicit. That algorithm, the thing that we do to A, can be implemented via a matrix multiplication. And that's the essential idea and purpose of these elementary matrices. Not to simplify calculations, but to have a different way of interpreting these elementary row operations. Okay, so that idea, hopefully in the back of your minds, let me show you now how you can calculate the inverse of a matrix. All right, let me move this again, see if we get things on screen. All right, so my hypothesis on this slide is my given matrix can be row reduced to the identity matrix. All right, so what that's going to mean, that means that I start with a matrix A and I start doing elementary row operations, some sequence of operations of those forms, that eventually I get A to be the identity matrix. So that's all tied up in this hypothesis, that there's going to be a sequence of row operations that transform A into the corresponding identity matrix. All right, so you have something like this set up. All right, now, here's where the elementary matrices come in. When you look at this line, I have to perform one row operation, then perform another row operation on the result until finally I reach the identity matrix. So this line is supposed to depict this process by which a sequence of elementary row operations changes a given matrix to the identity matrix. What we've seen in the preceding slides is that there's an alternative way of implementing these elementary row operations. We could do it via a matrix multiplication as well. But now, look at this. We have a certain matrix, just multiply these things together, times A produces the identity matrix. Well, that means that whatever matrix results from this product of elementary matrices, it times A produces the identity matrix. And so, in fact, what's enclosed inside the parentheses there has to be the inverse of A. Because anytime you have a matrix times another matrix producing the identity matrix, then the matrices are inverses of one another. Okay, so, maybe it's not showing at the bottom of the screen there. But basically what we've shown is that if you can row reduce a matrix to the identity matrix, then take the corresponding sequence of row operations, convert those, reinterpret those row operations as multiplication by the corresponding elementary matrix. So we can, once we know these row operations, we can do the same thing to the identity matrix and get a bunch of matrices. And then what this shows is that, in fact, this product of elementary matrices has to be the inverse of the original matrix. So we have at least now a procedure, a formal procedure at this point, that tells us that how we could calculate A the minus first. We figure out how to row reduce A to the identity matrix, take those elementary row operations in the same order, instead of applying them to A, apply them to the identity matrix, and then multiply everything together. And that will produce the inverse of A. Right? And so what do we have so far? You have a sequence of elementary row operations. Once you have that sequence, you can construct the corresponding elementary matrices, and you can construct that product. All right, but that's not very efficient. I'll show you how you can do it really quickly without having to figure out all these individual elementary matrices. All right, so what I'm going to do is something similar to what we've done before. I'm going to expand my coefficient matrix A, or this matrix A. I'm going to augment it with some additional columns. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put the N by N identity matrix, I'm going to just put it off to the right of the original matrix so that I have this matrix here is going to be called an augmented matrix. It's going to have the same number of rows as A, but the number of columns has been doubled. But what's here is the identity matrix, and what's here is the original matrix A. All right, so let's again assume that A can be row reduced to the identity matrix. Well, let's do the same sequence of row operations. And instead of operating on the matrix A, let's use them on this make this augmented matrix A or I adjoined with A. Then what will happen is these row operations, remember those row operations, the calculations you perform are column by column. You're adding a row to another row. That means you're adding a component to a like component. And if I add in more components, it's still the same operation. So if I interchange two rows, I can do that for A, or I can interchange the same two rows of this augmented matrix. So what will happen is when I apply the elementary row operation to this augmented matrix, it's going to have the same effect on both sides. The first row operation is going to be formed not only on this half, but it's also going to be formed on the right hand side, and so will subsequent operations. Our hypothesis is that we can row reduce A to the identity matrix. So this sequence of row operations applied to A is supposed to equal the identity matrix. But we also have the same sequence of row operation now being applied to the identity matrix. Well, so let's write that out. I'm just going to take this right-hand factor, write it out, and then these row operations, they could be implemented via matrix multiplication. I'll just take the operation and convert it to the corresponding elementary matrix. And rather than doing these directly on I, I'll carry out these operations by multiplying by the corresponding elementary matrices. And what happens then, when you look at that, what's going to get kicked out, it's exactly that product of elementary matrices that we already have identified as the inverse of A the minus first. These guys take A to the identity matrix, and so their corresponding products is going to of elementary matrices is going to be the inverse of A. Okay, so here's what we can conclude from this discussion. If you can row reduce a matrix A to the identity matrix, then when I adjoin the identity matrix to A, it's going to row reduce to, well, A is still going to row reduce to the identity matrix, but what's going to happen to this side? It's going to become exactly A the minus first. Okay, well, I have a minute left. So here's the conclusion. If you can row reduce A to the identity matrix, then by taking this matrix and row reducing it to its reduced row echelon form, the left-hand side is going to row reduce the identity matrix, and the right-hand side, what's going to happen to that is it's going to be whatever happens to this left-hand side under the row reduction that takes A to I here is going to get changed over to A the minus first. So whatever happened to the right-hand side of the augmented matrix, it's going to be the inverse of A. Well, let me state this as a theorem, and then I'll let you guys go. We'll pick up with this on Wednesday. If you have a square matrix and A can be row reduced to the identity matrix, then the way you calculate this this inverse of A is you row reduce this matrix to its reduced row echelon form. That will produce the identity matrix on the left-hand side, and what will be on the right-hand side is now your inverse. On the other hand, if A cannot be row reduced to the identity matrix, then that matrix A is not going to have an inverse at all. All right, so I'll stop here, and we'll pick up with this discussion on Wednesday. Thank you.